Critically, certainly emulated a lot of his dance moves, any of us who've written about the Southern stuff. But John's been out of the country a lot lately. Spent a better part of a year, I believe, in England, and I was very pleased to see that he had remembered some of his old lines about Atlanta. John, back before the Olympics, any journalist getting ready to write about Atlanta knew that they could speed dial John and get a nice sound bite about what a terrible, soulless place Atlanta was. I think John actually had a 1-800 trash Atlanta number. But I am a native of Atlanta, so I believe I should, before I get going with my comments on politics and barbecue, at least respond to a couple of things that he said about my hometown, a quiche town. First of all, you have to remember that John lives in a part of North Carolina that is actually very much like Atlanta. It just hasn't been as successful at doing it. The other thing you have to realize about Atlanta is I would never in a million years say Atlanta is as good a barbecue town as Memphis or Kansas City or Lexington, North Carolina, or Owensboro, Kentucky, or even Columbus, Georgia. But there is a lot of good barbecue, or Birmingham is a good barbecue town. There is a lot of good barbecue in Atlanta. There's a lot of good Southern cooking in Atlanta. What people sometimes mistake is that there has been so much growth in Atlanta, there's all this Thai food and sushi and stuff that's accreted in layers on top of it, so you have to work a little harder to find it. Rick Bragg's wrong. He said there weren't any good biscuits in Atlanta. Well, Rick just didn't know where to look. There are good biscuits in Atlanta. They're just not as obvious as they are in Natchez, Mississippi. We've got a lot of good barbecue there. The Olympics. John, I think you're remembering things a little bit wrong there. They actually went to great effort to try to get barbecue in the Olympics. They actually commissioned an official Olympic barbecue sauce that had about 5 or 6 different sweet things in it. It had Coca-Cola and some kind of syrup and peach preserves, and it was awful. And so they killed it because they didn't know how to do it. They did have barbecue at Centennial Olympic Park, and as you may recall, the opening ceremony actually began with with pickup trucks. I mean, can you get more Southern than that? So, you know, I would agree that Atlanta is conflicted about its Southern roots, but I think you exaggerate when you say we're ashamed of them. We are not. If your idea of the South is Natchez, Mississippi, Atlanta's not the South. If your idea of the South is broad enough to include the major metropolitan areas where most Southerners actually live now, Atlanta is probably one of the most interestingly, curiously Southern places on earth. So that's all I have to say about Atlanta. So there.
Don't hold back.
And we're defensive about it, too, if we happen to be from Atlanta. Okay. I have a very rich topic this morning, barbecue and politics. Anyone who's spent much time in the South knows that these two things go together like fat and flavor. But that kinship isn't always obvious to newcomers. I realized this a few years ago when my newspaper, the Journal Constitution's dining critic, asked me to go along with him as he checked out a new barbecue place. Well, not a new place. It's been there for a while, outside Atlanta, in Marietta, Williamson Brothers. I've been to that restaurant a few times. It shares a parking lot with the newspaper's Cobb County Bureau, and the aroma of the smoke always tantalizes me whenever I've worked out of that office. Now, our dining critic, John Kessler, John's from the Northeast, and while he truly loves barbecue, he doesn't always appreciate the culture of it the way most of us who grew up flicking gnats away from sauce-smeared paper plates do. John liked the ribs and the chopped pork and was feeling pretty good about the restaurant. Then he excused himself to visit the men's room, and he came back with this really sick expression on his face. And he said, "Have you seen the photos in the hallway back there?" And yeah, I'd noticed them before. Like a lot of people in the Atlanta suburbs, the Williamsons support conservative politicians. when the local congressman for Marietta, Newt Gingrich, was elected Speaker of the House in 1994, they went to Washington to do a barbecue for him and for all the other Republican revolutionaries who were taking over the Capitol, vowing to cut all the pork out of government. There's some pictures of Newt in the back hall near the restrooms. He's got these big nostrils and fleshy jowls, and he kind of looks like something the Williamsons might like to put over the coal, spread eagle. That Kessler, the dining critic, he's definitely not a conservative, and his sensitivities might have been a little bit on edge this night because the Monica Lewinsky affair was just starting to bust out. So when he came back to the table looking like the ribs were disagreeing with him, I assumed he had seen Newt grinning down from the hall back there. And he asked me, half-joking, how can you eat in a place like this? And I told him it was easy. In the South, we try to remember that the pigs are nonpartisan. Now, every political party from the Whigs and the Mugwumps to the Republicans and the Democrats has used barbecue as a way to gather votes and thank supporters and pass the hat and raise money. It's a long, honored tradition in our politics, right up there with stump speeches and campaign theme songs. In some states, like Georgia and North Carolina, barbecues are an almost expected part of the election season. I believe it was a Raleigh newspaper editor, wasn't it, Bob, who observed that no man has been elected governor of North Carolina without eating more barbecue than was good for him. And that dilemma, that question of low cholesterol or high voter approval ratings, is one that has deviled Southern politicians for years. You can't seem to have both at the same time. We've had barbecue people who became politicians. Till recently, the mayor of Augusta, Georgia, was a man named Larry Sconyers, whose principal claim to fame was that he ran the city's largest and best-known barbecue joint. Larry might have been the only mayor in America who wore a gold pig ring and a gold pig necklace and drove a car with a license tag that read Number One Pig. Of course, a little farther east in Columbia, South Carolina, they got Maurice Bessinger of Maurice's Piggy Park, who ran for governor and acts like he never lost. And you'll be hearing more about him in a little while, I think, from the next speaker. We've also had politicians who became barbecue people. You remember after he made his reputation as a political field general for Ronald Reagan and George Bush, Lee Atwater used his fame to do what any red-blooded Carolina boy really wants to do. He started playing guitar in a band and opened a chain of barbecue restaurants called Red Hot and Blue. We've had august bodies of lawmakers turn their energies to the important task of ensuring the quality of barbecue. I think it was in 1986 in South Carolina that legislators passed a Truth in Barbecue law requiring restaurants to disclose whether they used authentic hardwood smoke or attempted to hoodwink the public with gas or electricity. And I think we'd all agree that this was a case of worthwhile government regulation. We've also had barbecue restaurants figure in important legal precedents. I have always found it curious that the two most conspicuous challenges to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 involved eateries that specialized in the South's two most renowned dishes. In Atlanta, of course, we had one of them. It was Lester Maddox refusing to serve fried chicken to black folks at his restaurant, the Pickrick. He even chased them away with pick handles. He rode that notoriety all the way to the governor's office, of course. In Birmingham, it was Ollie McClung and his son, who filed a suit against the U.S. government rather than serve pig meat to black people in the dining room at Ollie's barbecue. The McClungs won a ruling in federal district court, but lost an appeal before the U.S. Supreme Court. Unlike Lester, who closed his restaurant rather than desegregate, Ollie had the good sense to remain open. We stopped by, my wife and I did, on the drive over and witnessed a bustling interracial crowd at lunchtime, which is, I think, one of the things that Martin Luther King had in mind all along. Come to think of it, there's a barbecue place in downtown Atlanta. There is barbecue in downtown Atlanta, where Martin Luther King and his lieutenants used to gather from time to time to have ribs and talk about what was going on in the movement, Alex Barbecue Heaven. Now, this intermingling of barbecue and politicking isn't a story just for people who grew up saying y'all. Take Newt Gingrich. As you probably know, Gingrich is an adoptive Southerner. Some of you may not want to claim him as a Southerner at all. He's an Army brat who grew up mostly in Pennsylvania. When he moved to Columbus, Georgia as a teenager, he developed a keen interest in politics and apparently absorbed the local conviction that pulled pork is one of the surest ways to a voter's heart. I've always found it interesting how newcomers to our region become some of the staunchest practitioners of our folkways, and Gingrich is certainly a good example of that. He began his career as a history professor at West Georgia College and soon became one of the most popular faculty members in Carrollton, in part because of the barbecues he threw for students at his house. Sometimes he'd even dig up part of his yard to cook a pig, hence the title of this talk. Clearly, this is a man who craved approval. And it's no wonder that when he became House Speaker, he celebrated with a big pig picking, catered by his favorite Republican pitmasters in Washington. Now, like the pigs, most barbecue joints are nonpartisan. But there are exceptions. Restaurants whose owners have such obvious leanings that they become known as much for their political loyalties as for the quality of their barbecue pork. And I ran across a dramatic example of this a few years ago in the town of Ellijay in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Georgia. Ellijay is a small place, population 1,200, but it has not one but two political barbecue joints. One is unabashedly Democratic, the other stridently Republican. They sit about 6 miles from each other beside the Appalachian Highway, which was renamed naturally for a politician. It's now the Zell Miller Mountain Parkway. The Republican place is Poole's Barbecue and Pig Hill of Fame. You may have seen a photo of this establishment. I brought one of their flyers. Behind the restaurant, there's a hillside studded with plywood pigs with names painted on them. The first time I drove past, I thought it was some folk artist's idea of a barbecue graveyard, an Arlington National Cemetery for pork with little memorials to all the pigs who made it possible. But the truth is more mundane. If you've got $5, the proprietor will put a pig up there with your name on it. Should I pass this around? It's pretty funny. I like on the flyer here, he's got one of his testimonials. It says, "The most truly American enterprise I've seen, it's so tacky, it's a classic." And this quote is from Ingmar something or other I can't pronounce from the Swedish embassy in Washington. noted barbecue expert. Here, I'm going to stick this down there and y'all pass it around. It's just kind of weird. Oop. There you go. Naturally, I have a picture of the pig with my name on it there. The place is run by a guy named Oscar Poole. He's a Methodist minister, retired Methodist minister, who repaired to the mountains after he left the ministry and tools around town in his pigmobile, a 1977 Velare, customized with a snout and pointed ears. Now, despite that show of irresponsible behavior, the Gilmer County GOP made Oscar their chairman. Every time Pat Buchanan rears up and runs for president, he always goes to Ellijay and does an appearance at Poole's and makes a few tired jokes about political pork. The Democratic barbecue place, and I'm not kidding about this name, it's the Pink Pig. Oscar Poole, who remembers the McCarthy era with great nostalgia, tells folks that it's actually the Pinko Pig. But, of course, barbecue aficionados know that the pinkness only refers to the smoke ring. The Pink Pig is run by a former truck driver named Bud Holloway. Over the years, he's cooked fundraising barbecues for Democrats like Zell Miller and Max Cleland and the late Herman Talmadge. But the Democrats he's closest to are Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter. Holloway moonlights as a carpenter, and he helped the Carters build their cabin retreat in the woods nearby, where the former president likes to hole up and write. The Carters drop in pretty often with the Secret Service to eat barbecue with Bud, and Holloway naturally has pictures of them all over the restaurant. And back a few years ago, before Carter's stock had risen a lot in the ex-presidency, people would sometimes come in and make boorish comments about what lousy president Jimmy Carter was. And Bud really got upset by that, and he told me, you know, people would come in here and say ugly things about him, and I would have to ask them to leave. He didn't put up with it. So this is the little pink pig here, and I wrote a story about, I think before the 96 election, I wrote a story about these two competing barbecue places, and here we've got Bud and his overalls on the left. The quote out says, Republicans don't go much for barbecue. They go for $100 a plate dinners. Bud Holloway, D. Cherry Log. And then here's Oscar. It says, this is conservative barbecue. We cut out the fat. Oscar Poole, R. Elijah. And so there they are. I was happy to see that when Carter won the Nobel Peace Prize last week, my newspaper called Bud Holloway for a reaction. The owner of the pink pig was quoted in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution right beside Andrew Young and Bishop Desmond Tutu. Two admirable men, to be sure, but can they smoke a pig? Now, speaking of Jimmy Carter, I thought it would be instructive to trace the history of political barbecue through our presidents. Probably half the men who've occupied the office knew something about barbecue, starting with George Washington and continuing right through to our current George W. Washington, of course, hosted the first barbecues at Mount Vernon and is known to have made one of the first American references to a public barbecue in his diary. He wrote that he was going up to Alexandria for 3 days for a barbecue. He spelled it B-A-R-B-I-C-U, thus setting a dangerous precedent for all the misspellings that would appear on restaurant signs in future generations. And the diary entries from 1763, so we can only hope that the father of our country still had his natural teeth and could enjoy gnawing the ribs. Now, by the time Andrew Jackson took office a few decades later, political barbecues had become a bona fide institution. There's a editorial cartoon, I think it's in y'all's book, 1001 Things You Should Know About the South, a cartoon from the 1830s showing Jackson's enemies turning him on a spit. Old Hickory appears as a pig, complete with hooved extremities and a curly tail. The cartoonist was a stickler for detail because he apparently knew that Tennesseans prefer pork. Now, the president who perfected the political barbecue was probably William Henry Harrison, a Virginia native who won fame as an Indian fighter at the Battle of Tippecanoe in the Northwest Territories. Every history student has learned his slogan, campaign slogan, Tippecanoe and Tyler too. It was probably the most honest part of his campaign. His handlers wanted to persuade voters that Tippecanoe was a man of the people like Andy Jackson, so they staged enormous barbecues around the country, always erecting a log cabin as the centerpiece to symbolize their man's humble roots. Never mind that Harrison grew up in a plantation manor in Virginia. The barbecues were festive and entertaining, and voters loved them, but not all voters. One abolitionist minister, we've got a quote from him coming down through the years, the Reverend J.D. Long, disapproved of what these spectacles implied about the values of the electorate. And he wrote, quote, there is not much difficulty in the South in raising money for a barbecue or to buy whiskey for political purposes, but when the funds are wanted for a library, that is quite another question. And I'd say the parson kind of nailed us. Many years after Harrison died in office, my hometown of Atlanta, always John Eager to suck up, tried to impress another president in a most peculiar way. William Howard Taft, our largest chief executive, visited Atlanta in 1909, and the city threw him a banquet that was commensurate with the president's impressive circumference. They served 600 people and had to hold it in the new municipal auditorium, the Georgia World Congress Center of its time. Among the 32 dishes on the menu was barbecued possum. History does not record whether Taft was impressed or horrified by this offering of smoked marsupial. Now, the modern president who made the most of barbecue as food and symbol was undoubtedly Lyndon B. Johnson. LBJ loved to show off his ranch for the same reason politicians of Harrison's time liked to claim a log cabin berth. The ranch spoke of LBJ's roots in the dirt of the Texas Hill Country. And as if that weren't enough to make the point, Johnson liked to take visitors out for a spin in his Lincoln Continental, driving so fast that he'd cover the speedometer with his Stetson so reporters couldn't see how high the needle was going. Some journalists claimed that he'd drink a beer or two while he was out speeding around Texas and toss the cans out the window, but Johnson always denied that. He said Lady Bird would have killed him if she'd thought he was a litter bug. In his 5+ years in office, Johnson hosted more than 100 barbecues on the LBJ Ranch. That's incredible. One of the most memorable was the first one he staged for a visiting head of state, the Chancellor of Germany, who came in 1963, a little more than a month after the Kennedy assassination. The media was quite amused by the prospect of such an event coming so soon after the Eastern sophistication of the Kennedy years. One New York newspaper dubbed it, quote, barbecue diplomacy, end quote. There's a real good retelling of this barbecue in a book that came out last year, LBJ's Texas White House by Hal K. Rothman. Before he became president, LBJ's barbecues were usually pretty down-home affairs with lots of gingham and fiddle music and corny comedy from an MC by the name of Cactus Pryor, who reminded everyone of Will Rogers. Kind of sounds to me like the scene from Oklahoma where they sing the farmer and the rancher should be friends. But now Lyndon Baines Johnson is the leader of the free world, and it dawns on his entourage that maybe they should strive for a more presidential tone. I mean, the chancellor wouldn't welcome them to Germany and Lederhosen, would he? So Cactus Pryor, of all people, the humorist, suggests that they show the world that Texans aren't a bunch of cowhands by inviting Van Cliburn down to perform. The acclaimed pianist had grown up in Fort Worth, and he quickly agreed to come. Only when he gets to the ranch, he finds out that they want him to perform in blue jeans and a red checkered shirt like the rest of the help. Maybe they wanted to put him to work basting the brisket before he took the stage. Clyburn protested that he always performed in a tux. And when no one could find a tux, he consented to wear a business suit. In the end, the barbecue and the contest were a tremendous success, although it was probably the last time Clyburn ever played in a basketball arena. Because of the cold weather, the event had to be moved at the last minute from the ranch to the Stonewall High School gymnasium. Now, I was interested to see that our current president has tried to revive this tradition of presidential barbecues in Texas. Last November, George W. Bush had Vladimir Putin down to Crawford for a summit conference at his ranch. After the barbecue, some students were allowed to ask the Russian president a few questions, and one of them wanted to know his opinion of the mesquite-smoked tenderloin. And here's his answer, as provided by the translator. Quote, I had a hard time imagining how could a living person create such a masterpiece of cooking. I'm a little concerned about that living person part. do dead people cook in Russia? I mean, if you ever get over there and see something on the menu called barbecue, my advice is perhaps you better pass up. Now, as far as I can tell from this historical review, there's no correlation between presidential greatness and great barbecue. In fact, one of our most exalted presidents, Franklin D. Roosevelt, I am wearing a button for Roosevelt and John Nance Garner, I think from the 1932 campaign. Would that we had a choice like that now. Roosevelt may have set the standard for the most pathetic attempt at alfresco state dining. In 1939 at Hyde Park, New York, if you can believe it, he actually served hot dogs to the King and Queen of England. Unimpressive food, but clever political imagery. FDR was trying to show America that our partner in the fight against Hitler was, if not a regular George, at least willing to eat like one from time to time. I would hope that the president knew enough from his extended stays in Warm Springs, Georgia, not to call this little weenie roast a barbecue. But I wouldn't be so sure about Eleanor. Now, it was Tip O'Neill who said that all politics is local, and I think the same could be said of barbecue. Every part of the South has its distinctive traditions when it comes to political pork. In western Kentucky, office seekers flock to the mutton barbecue and burgoo feeds that they have at the Catholic churches around Owensboro to raise funds. In North Carolina, anyone who wants votes around Charlotte knows to work the crowd at the Mallard Creek Presbyterian Church's annual autumn barbecue, which has been known to draw as many as 20,000 people. In Tennessee, you wouldn't think of running for office without strolling through the tipsy multitudes at the Memphis in May barbecue contest. I'm going to show you one more photo. I saw a photo of Al and Tipper Gore at Memphis in May a few years ago eating ribs. It really is not flattering. Their teeth are bared like wolves ripping into a small mammal. And if you look at this, you would probably conclude that the wise politician ought to spend more time at barbecue contests pumping hands than pumping by cuspids. Now, the state that claims the largest political barbecue in history is not, as you might expect, Texas. It's Oklahoma. When he took office as governor in 1923, Jack Walton, a Democrat, promised Oklahomans an old-fashioned square dance and barbecue the likes of which had never been seen. Listen to this menu. It is positively biblical in proportions. 289 head of cattle, or beeves, as they called them back then, 70 hogs, 36 head of sheep, 2,540 rabbits, 134 possums, 25 squirrels, 2,000 pounds of bison, 1,500 pounds of reindeer, 1,500 deer, 1,427 chickens, 210 turkeys, 14 geese, 34 ducks, one antelope, and 1 5-year-old boy from Tulsa. This menu sounds to me like the passenger manifest for Noah's Ark if Noah had been a butcher. By the time the festivities wound down, more than 50,000 citizens had been fed, and the decimated fields and forests around Oklahoma City were very, very quiet. Now, in my state of Georgia, there's one name that's synonymous with politics and barbecue, and that is Talmadge. It started back in the 1920s with Eugene Talmadge, a rural populist who was Georgia's version of Huey Long without much of the substance. In barbecue terms, we would say that Gene Talmadge was all sauce. He hit the sauce too, of course. It was complications from cirrhosis of the liver that finally killed Talmadge in the 1940s. Old Gene, as his followers knew him, was a colorful stump speaker who'd stand up there snapping his red suspenders, a flock of hair flying loose, and denounce the city slickers in the state capitol and them lying Atlanta newspapers that told the truth about him. He liked to say that there were only three things in the world that the poor dirt farmers of Georgia could trust: God Almighty, the Sears Roebuck catalog, and Gene Talmadge. Talmadge kicked off his first campaign for governor in 1932 with a huge barbecue that drew 10,000 people to his hometown of Macrae in Middle Georgia. The farmers donated pigs and goats and cows and chickens, and a local man, Norman Graham, known as the Barbecue King, was appointed to oversee the cooking, which took 36 hours to complete. A crowd of townspeople came out to watch, as if the barbecuing and not the speech-making were the point of it all. William Anderson, in his excellent biography of Talmadge, The Wild Man from Sugar Creek, described the scene on the night before as they fired up the Brunswick stew pots. Quote, "Insects swirled and buzzed crazily into the string of naked light bulbs that wound over the pits, giving a hard brightness to the cooking area. So many bugs flew into the kettles of stew, drawn there by its sweet aroma, that no pepper had to be added for flavor. As one of the men explained, bugs was good spice." This confirms many of our worst fears about the ingredients of Southern stews. Talmadge wrote his barbecues and his conservative populism to multiple terms as Georgia governor. My former colleague, the Atlanta Constitution, Celestine Sibley, covered Talmadge toward the end of his life. She liked to tell a story about what happened to him during one of his campaign appearances. He was headed to a rally in South Georgia. I think it might have been a fish fry, not a barbecue, but same principle. And he asked the driver to pull over at the next farm so he could borrow a man's outhouse. And Gene liked to show his common touch that way, you know. So Gene goes in there to take care of business. I'm kind of hoping there was nothing to use but a scratchy old Sears Roebuck catalog. And while he's sitting in there, a black widow spider bites him on the butt. By the time he got to the rally, his undercarriage had swollen up like a nursing sow, and he wasn't able to do much but say hello, goodbye, and get himself to a doctor. Now, Hermantown, his Gene's son, followed him in the governor's office in the late 1940s and continued the tradition of Talmadge pork. Actually, it was more Herman's wife, Betty Talmadge. She started a business curing and selling Talmadge hams from their plantation in Lovejoy, south of Atlanta. She always claimed it was the model for 12 Oaks and Gone with the Wind, and she loved having political barbecues on the grounds there that recalled the one that begins Margaret Mitchell's novel. She made the most of that connection. Now, Betty and Herman Talmadge went through a bitter public divorce in the late 1970s. But just before it hit the headlines, Betty published a recipe book called How to Cook a Pig, in which she reminisces about a big barbecue she threw for the Carters during the 1976 presidential campaign. If you're looking for an indication of how far the South has come in the past few decades, I would nominate the fact that pigs have gone from the likes of dying for the likes of Gene Talmadge to the likes of Jimmy and Rosalind Carter. Now, let me mention just briefly the man who succeeded Herman Talmadge as governor. He figures in this survey, if only for one folksy comment he made at the end of his career. Marvin Griffin was a small-town newspaper man, editor of the Bainbridge Searchlight in South Georgia, which has always been my favorite name among all the newspaper names in Georgia, the Bainbridge Searchlight. Now, being a newsman, Marvin knew how to craft a quote. Unfortunately, he didn't know how to be a good governor. He spent most of his term in the mid-1950s defending segregation, and his remarkably corrupt administration. There was another newspaper man who said Griffin's philosophy of government could be summed up by saying, if you ain't for stealing, you ain't for segregation. It was on Marvin's watch that Georgia adopted the rebel state flag that caused us so much grief until it was replaced by Governor King Roy Barnes last year. Georgia governors back then were restricted to one term in office at a time. So Griffin had to leave office in 1959. He decided to run for another term in 1962, and he pulled out all the old tricks. He was still as racist as ever. He vowed to put Martin Luther King Jr., quote, so far back in the jail you'd have to pump air to him. And of course, he used all the old-fashioned campaign tools, including the Talmadge-style barbecues from one end of the state to the other, or as we say in Georgia, from Tybee Island to Raven Gap. Griffin's opponent was more savvy. Carl Sanders was a handsome attorney from Augusta who didn't look or sound like the kind of man who would embarrass Georgia in the nation's eyes. They called him Cufflinks Carl in a later campaign. He put his faith in television advertising more than barbecues and stump speaking. I was 7 years old during that race, and one of the earliest political memories I have is of the Sanders theme song to the tune of Are You From Dixie? It was, Are You From Sanders? Yes, I'm for Sanders. But apparently most Georgians were, because after Griffin lost the Democratic primary that year, he seemed to realize that he was a victim of changing times. He told a reporter that he had been deceived by the size of his campaign crowds, which were easily larger than Sanders. That may have meant something in the old days, but it didn't necessarily matter anymore. And here's the way he put it, and I love this quote. Everybody that ate my barbecue, I don't believe voted for me. I need to remember that quote next time our dining critic asks me how I can eat ribs at a place that displays Newt Gingrich photos. In the 40 years since that election, the place of barbecue in politics has evolved considerably. You don't have many pig pickings nowadays. It's usually a $500 a plate fundraiser where the party faithful can rub elbows with the candidate, or a catered affair to celebrate a triumph like Newt's ascension as House Speaker. Political barbecues are no longer campaign necessities. Like so many things in American life, they've become, in large part, self-conscious allusions to our shared heritage. Politicians used to believe they could sway votes with a dram of whiskey or a plate of pork. Now they do the same thing with tax cuts and state lotteries to fund Hope scholarships. The barbecue was cheaper. But that doesn't mean that this tradition is coming to an end. In fact, today there's a whole new field of political barbecue, I would argue, the cook-off circuit. If you've ever been to Memphis in May, or the Big Pig Jig in Georgia, or any of the dozens of other barbecue contests throughout the region, you know that there's more going on there than a redneck Mardi Gras. These competitions are as political in their own way as anything the Talmadge has ever engineered. Like the craftiest lobbyists on Capitol Hill, cooking teams do everything in their power to influence the judges. At least they do on the Memphis in May circuit, where that's part of the rules. And like all but the most honest legislators, the judges can be influenced. And it doesn't even take cash under the table. Usually a cold beer on a hot day will be enough to grease the wheels of deliberation. But after the lobbying and after the tasting, in the end, it still comes down to one person, one vote. And it's then that the conscientious judge realizes that Thomas Jefferson, that quasi-vegetarian, was wrong. All ribs are not created equal. I don't know about you, but I am thankful to live in a country where a person is free to support the barbecue of his choice, where you can even dig up your front yard to smoke a pig like Newt, if it isn't against neighborhood covenants. So I want to end this talk the way George W. Bush probably would, by gazing into the camera, finding that red light, looking as sincere as I possibly can, and saying to my fellow citizens, God bless the pigs, God bless the politicians, and God bless American barbecue. Sure. Yeah.
This is a part comment, part question.
Yes.
The first thing is that I would not like you to leave out of your list of things the fact that Jimmy Bentley, who was many times called Talmadge's brother because they looked so much alike, a close friend of many Talmadge's, was frequently in charge of cooking the pigs. He was the insurance commissioner as well. And he felt that the ideal pit was a six-pack pit.
Yeah.
So two men, one six-pack, sufficiently.
As long as it took them to drink one six-pack was as big as the pit should be, yeah. Jimmy is a legendary barbecuer and Brunswick stew maker in Atlanta, who lives actually in the oldest house in the city of Atlanta. He's a friend, and he's a great resource on all this stuff. And Natalie's quite correct that he's the living link to this tradition of political old style courthouse political barbecues in Georgia. I appreciate barbecue on Sunday. I mean, I've not noticed any correlation between not having it on Sunday, but I'll look for it now.
Going once, going twice, so all right. Thank you, Mr.